There are so many things in here that point to...
Well, okay, if people want to read that book, I encourage them, read it. Read it with an open mind, but that's really not... doesn't have much to do with what we're talking about here. So I'm going to have to let you go, but we will. I encourage people to find out as much as they can about all these cases. So we're getting near the end of our time, sort of trying to wrap this show up. I would just say that a lot of these cases are not as open and shut as our media makes them appear to be. You know, we've been hearing a lot about the poisoning of Alexei Navalny and what you get on the mainstream news, even the more elevated mainstream news on NPR, is that to them it seems to be an open and shut case. It was done by, on behalf of, maybe even ordered by Vladimir Putin. Well, that's a possibility, but I wouldn't rule out other possibilities, which we have outlined, some of our callers outlined them. And so that is something I would just say, keep an open mind, keep investigating. You can go online and check out some of these people. Also look into the case of Sergei Skripal. It's a very interesting case, and a lot has been said about it, and there are people who have been who continue to investigate the Skripal case. Craig Murray is one, and Rob Slain with his Blogmire blog is another. And so if you're interested, you can go online and look these people up and satisfy your curiosity, because there is very, very much to be curious about. So I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank our callers, and stay tuned to KBOO. It's your radio station.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we have a special program on policing and public health, which was put together by Physicians for Human Rights. Before we get started, I'd just like to remind everyone that you can donate today at kbu.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Support KBOO now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kbu.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Now on to today's show.
Despite your mental illness, quite resilient. Fight with wit and right, it's real volatility. Low stability, don't let vulnerability lower your agility. This moment is pivotal. Crucial, critical, my opponent is intentional. Brutally criminal, to be truthful, I respond has been useful and pitiful. Community defense happens when we control the city, though. Perversity, virtually, worship in emergencies, a constant state of urgency. Crisis creates currency, mass murder and the mayhem, massacres and strife, manufacturing the chaos, the fascist race is right. Merchants cut a weaponry and sell it to all sides. No guarantees with no tranquility after we all die. Hostility, rage and anger killing me. Make them in atrocities, plausible deniability. We must achieve the impossible, believe in our abilities. I'ma look to you and me, not Hollywood or Hillary. Politicians and police can't keep the bourgeoisie. Liberation's closer than you think, but y'all ain't really feeling me. It's time to think fast, the movement. Learn lessons from my past, the movement. Organize the class, the movement. Solidarity at last, the movement. And yo, it's time to think fast, the movement. Learn lessons from my past, the movement. Organize the class, the movement. Solidarity at last, the movement. Y'all will say we know about that.
But what about the love? What about the good Lord and the heavens up above? The heavens up above, they are inside of you. Don't forget about the essence of the message, try to do. And to the hell below, we have access to that too. Depending on what you know, what you think, and what you do. I'm posted on the radio, no surveillance with my crew. But the phone and from the drone, they spy on me and you. Oh, you think you're cool? They spying on you too. I know you think I'm a fool, but they spying on you too. So what you gonna do? What we gonna do? What you gonna do? What we gonna do?
It's time to think fast.
Come on, man.
Learn lessons from my past.
Come on, man.
Organize the draft.
The movement.
Solidarity at last.
The movement.
Hey, yo, it's time to think fast.
The movement.
That was Portland artist Mike Crenshaw with The Movement, recorded right here in the streets of Portland in June of 2020. This hour, we present a webinar on policing and public health, was organized by Physicians for Human Rights on August 27th, 2020. The three panelists featured in this discussion are Rhea Boyd, a pediatric doctor and leader of the California Children's Trust, Mark Krapansky with the Open Society Foundation, and Teresa Rayford, the founder of Don't Shoot Portland, an advocacy organization that works for justice for Black, Brown, and Indigenous people in Portland, Oregon. The panel is moderated by Mary Bassett, a doctor who heads the Francois Xavier Bagnoud Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University.
So we have three wonderful panelists, and I thought I would begin by just noting that when we all talked and first began a discussion of how we would go forward with this panel on police violence, we were reflecting at that time on the extrajudicial police killings of the year that included George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Rashard Brooks, and more. And now we have another name to add to the list of names we all must know. And I thought I would just ask the panelists, starting with you, Rhea, how are you feeling?
I appreciate you starting with that because, you know, these moments in the last few months have been incredibly heated between periods of mourning. I think today, as I sit here right now, I feel an incredible amount of rage that I think is giving me a lot of mental clarity. And to be honest, much of my work over the past months, I think, has been driven by that same type of rage. So I think right now I'm holding rage and I'm holding gratitude because, you know, many of us are enraged and few of us will have an outlet like this to actually talk about it and to discuss our work in context. So I'm appreciative for this moment, but I have a lot of rage.
Thank you, Rhea. And I'll remind the panelists, you might as well go ahead and unmute. We're going to have a conversation. Mark, would you like to share with us how you've been feeling? I assume everyone watching knows that that this young man, I believe he was just 29 years old, was shot at point blank range 7 times in the back by a police officer who was holding onto his shirt. That's what the video shows. Mark.
How I'm feeling, I'm having a hard time really placing into words. I'm feeling a mixture of deep sadness and rage as well. I can't help but keep thinking as well for myself as a father, but thinking of that he had his, I believe, 3 sons in a car with him as well. Mm-hmm. And what that does to them as well in terms of witnessing that. But I try to anchor myself in groups declare strongly and boldly that Black Lives Matter and that police violence must end. And so work of groups like Don't Shoot Portland and what Terry says has been leading really inspired me. And so I try to anchor myself
Teresa, you're on the front lines and you probably know the words already, don't mourn, organize.
Well, the feelings that I have is that it's a shame, it's all of our shame that another shooting like this provides evidence to something that we all know is true. And that's that we basically operate on this racist policy that allows the dehumanization of people in this country based on systemic social, class, racial constructs.
Police have been empowered to take people's lives. And over the years, any kind of, you know, efforts to push forward accountability have often been dismissed as Monday morning quarterbacking, difficult to judge in a split second. And often officers' own testimony of just being fearful is sufficient grounds to prevent any kind of charges being brought forward, or let alone a conviction. I think some studies have shown that, you know, in the over thousands of killings that have been taking place, the officers who have actually been convicted have only been, you know, under 20. So I think policing as a system in our country is one that is inherently rooted in violence. Violence is baked into the makeup of policing. So that's why, you know, any kind of encounter, even a casual encounter that might occur, whether it's somebody selling loose cigarettes, whether it's somebody asleep in their vehicle in a fast food restaurant, you know, whether it's somebody taking a wallet out of their pocket going into their home at night, there's always that risk, inherent risk of violence being perpetrated by the police.
I guess that's why some people use the phrase structural violence, suggesting that it's not simply one police officer at a time, but as you point out, that the whole enterprise of policing has violence structured into it. Teresa, I know you've been on the streets of Portland, and people remain on the streets of Portland. Can you talk with us about the concept of police accountability? We know the numbers that Mark has given us, but I'm sure you have more to share.
Absolutely. In the work that we've done over the last 10 years since my nephew was murdered, one of the things that we've sought in our protest in organizing is information on the record from agencies involved in community policing, because our effort is to dismantle the policies, because we know that you can't legislate morality. You can't, you know, elect or appoint someone that's going to do the right thing in a system that is inherently set up to disproportionate, values for people. So what we've done is we've demanded audits. When you talk about the underrepresentation of data, we've looked at the in-custody deaths, the policing brutality, the referrals to mass incarceration, the children taken into foster care, the homicides, the illiteracy, the health disparities, the lack of housing access. We've looked at that overrepresentation in our community as advocates, and we've gotten people to speak out on the record and to determine that we want to see where there is actual investment in solutions, and there are none. In community policing, the whole managed health framing, education framing, and city investment framing is to identify criminals and to insert constitutional values to benefit from that incarceration. And the fact that they use policing in these areas to kind of create the framework to provide referrals to the agencies, that is a brutal force of violence in itself, because it creates a disproportionate and an overrepresentation of those communities that are already deemed vulnerable because of the funding that goes into the agencies. So when you look at the component of policing, that additional violence, not only does it trigger the violent response to children that grow up in a school that's policed by police as it is in gang task force or in our agencies here in Portland that we call community policing, most of the people that shoot the children, that are involved in deadly shootings or police brutality actually know the people that they're involved in. And a lot of times when we do the audits on who those people were or the police reports, there's no deadly encounter. There's just a fear. And you have to ask yourself, if you've been involved with this person's life or this community since, let's say, early childhood education, and then you're killing them before they're 20 years old, why hadn't you spoke about the fear? Why isn't there a trigger in the mandates that would recuse someone from that type of environment? Because they have like some kind of social norm or reality that introduces this as fear. We don't have safety net for people in regards to public safety when it comes to policing. And the fact that we continue to use policing as a public safety measure is just, it's disgusting. And it has direct disastrous impact. I mean, it's just fact.
What happened with your nephew?
He was killed in gun violence on September 26th of 2010. And because in Portland, Black people are deemed to be criminal or at risk or marginalized or disadvantaged on the record, they don't provide immediate life preservation or any kind of resource. So they allowed him to die rather than administering first aid or allowing an ambulance to administer first aid. And when I realized that was something that was usual and customary for Black children in our community, or people that they had a whole gang task force set up for that included funding and parts with the health department, I felt that it was odd that they would find a partnership that would not include life preservation of people that don't get it or they're deemed a victim or a suspect in a shooting. And just basically based on their color, if he had been a white suspect or a white person that got gunned down because isn't the shooter, he was one of 200 people that were outside, then they would have administered first aid to save his life. But because he connected to what they said was gang violence because Black, which we've audited that agency, and it seems that they only identify you as Black, enlist you as a gang member so that they can to share referral services. It's like racketeering, but it's just bad. But he got killed, and I did a ton of audits. It just showed that he died unnecessarily because he didn't matter.
Rhea, you're a pediatrician as well as a researcher in this area. I'm sure you have something to say. I'm trying to, you know, we're all trying to figure out how to work with Zoom, and I want you all to be able to talk to each other as well without me being the necessarily all of the lines of conversation coming from me. But Rhea.
Thank you. Teresa, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I appreciate the grace and patience it takes for you to talk us through what happened to your nephew and all of the work that you do. I'll only really underscore, I think, the points Mark and Teresa have made. You know, Mapping Police Violence, which is an online database that tracks police-related shootings, because we don't have that national database. The Washington Post has a similar one. Guardian has a similar one. Police killings are another one. Anyway, they've tracked cases from 2013 to 2019, and in 99% of police killings, there is no officers who are charged. I mean, even charged. It's not just that, you know, folks don't kind of beat their case. These things are never even charged. There are never even trials. We as a community have never been able to actually weigh in on that type of injustice through our justice system. And when it's that profound, when it's 99% of a lack of accountability, that what you did was even wrong or against the law, I think that's what calls us to have to think more broadly about what we mean by policing in general. Because I want to reframe a little bit. I think when Michelle opened for us, she talked specifically about police violence, and then she said something about excessive force. And I think what we really need to be talking about is policing as an institution, and the idea that it would be acceptable for any force to be used, right, as a form of social control. Like, we cede the fact that police can use force as a form of social control, and then we only penalize excessive uses of force, right? Like, there's a problem with that. I think we as a society have to talk about why we invest more in punishment than other types of public goods, which I think in a way can speak to some of what Teresa just said about the lack of first aid that's offered. you know, it's because we as a society have not invested evenly in caring economies as we have in punitive economies. And I think our disproportionate investments in policing as institutions that are paid for by our tax dollars at every level of government, I think reflects that imbalance, reflects like a very serious problem. And that problem is not just with violence. It is with the use of this institution to try to control folks, which is a part of, you know, racism in this country, frankly.
I see Mark nodding his head. And I think there are simple questions that we can ask, like, why do you need three police officers to show up at all for a counterfeit $20 bill with police officers show up with guns? I mean, why do you need that? And that's really what you're asking about, is this the fact that underlying the notion of public safety is really the notion of social control, and the perspective that an entire community is dangerous and cruel and criminal. And sometimes this goes under the heading of structural racism. I think we've already heard earlier the notion of systemic racism, and that violent policing period is part of the of structural racism. So the word's being used a lot. I'll just let whoever wants to go first talk a little bit about how we should think about this concept of structural racism and where it will take us in terms of finding a way forward for this country, because structural racism dates back before the founding of this country.
One way to begin might be to think about what role policing as an institution plays within our political economy. Like, why do we feel like we are a country that needs policing? And was there ever a time when we didn't have policing? And the answer to that is yes. Policing is not just a natural institution. It's not, you know, it's not, it hasn't always existed in the way that it has now. You know, in the South, police began as slave patrols to try to quell the uprisings of enslaved folks and slave revolts. In the North, police were often just conscripted criminals, frankly, who were penalized by serving as what was called the watch, where they just had to, instead of participating in labor forces and work and earn income, had to watch for other quote-unquote criminals. So I think the roots of policing are certainly not this pillar of public safety that we make it today. And I think we then have to question, well, what is it that allows us to continue to allow this institution to exist when it reliably, predictably, disproportionately harms and leaves certain communities less safe? And I'm definitely talking about Black communities. I'm talking about Indigenous communities. In certain areas of the United States, Indigenous Americans have the highest rates of police killings, particularly on tribal lands. And Latinx communities. I'm talking about immigration policing and how we police undocumented communities in this country. And so we have to allow, why do we do that? Like, where does that come from? And I think it opens up a conversation about our political economy and our investments in this country. Like, we have a political economy, racial capitalism, that is rooted in the subjugation of folks based on their racial, you know, backgrounds. And policing serves the role of continuing to create that hierarchy of folks. That's why we talk about social control. What you're trying to control is how people relate to each other in a hierarchical system, a capitalist system, where certain people are going to amass more resources than others. And so I think policing in many ways functions to protect that order. It's why police will defend property over people, because that protects that order. It's why you won't administer first aid, because your first order of business is to ensure that the businesses that are there and the folks whose businesses those are protected above all costs. And when you confront that, you are also confronting our political economy. And I think it's why it is considered so radical to ask the question, how do you reimagine public safety without policing?
I have to fully agree. Yes. Fully agree with what you said, Rhea. And I think, you know, with the starting point as well in terms of what is our conception of order and disorder, and who is orderly and disorderly, and particularly a presence in public space. And I think as well, you know, the notion that everybody wants to feel safe, but why is there the notion that safety is only the grounds for law enforcement and through the use of force to be produced, rather than through social services and public health interventions, and who is safety for? One of the moments, you know, now 15 years ago that really struck this clearly for me was in the response to Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and just watching people without homes, without electricity, a hospital shut down, and that these weren't considered the markers of disorder, but instead what was considered disorder was the over-reporting, it's now been proven, of alleged looting. And so then what order was, how order came to be reestablished, is when the National Guard was sent in, when the New Orleans Police Department was sent in and used exceptional use of force to detain people and control people, mostly Black New Orleans residents. That was how order is restored, not when hospitals and electricity and housing is. And the political economy point is especially important. For a number of years in New York City, I worked around the issue of challenging the use of stop and frisk by the New York Police Department. And studies now have shown, you know, that there is a direct link between the massive use of stop, question, and frisk in Black and Brown neighborhoods, you know, stopping over 600,000 people a year with gentrification, and seeing the massive presence of police stopping Black and Latinx people as a precursor for gentrifying particular neighborhoods as well.
Yeah. And Teresa, you've also spoken really expansively about what it means to be safe, and what it means to have a society that protects people, not just about guns, but about the right to be, to have housing, education, good health. I guess I'm gonna, we have a whole lot of questions coming in. So I'm gonna ask the last question that's from me, and then I'll turn to turning some from the people who are listening or watching. And that's just to ask the question about, and in a way, Rhea has already addressed this, in the framing of the concept of police reform. And Rhea has said that, you know, we're kind of past just talking about reforming an institution. Mm-hmm. We really are up to talking about dismantling and reimagining the way we keep communities safe. But still, there's a lot of conversation goes on about police reform, and let's talk a little bit about what that means, what it means to focus on an individual police officer as the problem, and what it means to suggest that training can fix those problems.
Well, I hang out with a lot of archivists and historians to kind of look at what in error language has happened or occurred in regards to police reform. And when we talk about reform, we talk about building committees, having oversight, building more political engagement with affected communities. There's been a lot of, you know, conversations not only about the necessity of training, but also that officers live in their communities. And through generation, past generation, past generation, all of those things have been said by really collected individuals that are in a framework that is literally overseen by the police. And the outcome of these opinions and advice, and even the instituted use of these ideas, have not made communities safer ever. We don't have evidence that any of these protocols with police using, you know, different techniques like tasers instead of bullets or ropes, you know, that hasn't led to less brutality in our communities. It hasn't led to less terror in our families, in our neighborhoods, in the way that we socially interact, the fact that we have a policing element at all that leads to violence or could lead to the disenfranchisement of families based on your demographics or your color, that inherently is violent. That is a tool that is utilized to provide the authority of that violence. And so what Dr. Boyd was saying in dismantling, that is the construct that we need to deconstruct. It's not about reforming it to a point where we literally legislate or legalize a training ability to identify that there's violence happening, or to institute some type of credentialing for officers to say that they're less violent because they've taken this type of measure to educate themselves on bias or racism. It inherently is a tool used for violence. It inherently is a tool that is used to harm people and to oppress people and to create a discriminative state for people in this country. And that is what is so alarming to so many people around the globe, that not only do we institute policies that are framed and upheld by policing agencies, but that the same taxpayers that are harmed by them are usually the ones that pay the most for these services. And so when we talk about dismantling, we have to talk about the reinvestment of those funds being the ulterior motive of those who need the dismantling to happen. Those motives are necessary. They're healthy. They're more innovative. They're economically sound. They create different infrastructure. They don't give way to some violence use instead of the introduction of solutions. When we talk about how the unhoused communities are treated in this country, and how people have been, you know, witness to sweeping of people who we've already said have like a mental, you know, harm that is happening to them, and that is also being attributed to the reason that they're unhoused. The fact that we would center violence in order to remove them and not have any kind of critical investment in housing them or getting them direct services or advocating for them in some way, that again is inherently violent, because you would not see that type of harm happening to someone that is in the general 1% class of elite people. They would ask the question first, what can we do to help you? We do not ask those questions. We put people that have health challenges in jails where we know that the health challenge is going to exacerbate. We tell them to get out and to utilize all these systems to refer to us evidence that they're sound and that they're competent to continue forth, but we don't identify ways that we can undermine the systems that created the process that brought them into the jail in the first place. We put all of that burden on those same people that we call marginalized, at risk, or vulnerable in language that we use to legislate funding. Like, they use the same language to get authority funding and to get resource funding, but we only use violence in order to address these issues, because police are the frontline people and are the ones with the most access to funding. My thought is that if we utilize what we know to build research into instituting new ways to create outreach to the people that are unhealthy in society because of systemic policies that oppress them, I think that we would have a better return on investment for society and for the future. I think that when we look at the age of the people that are protesting police violence right now, they're not all affected by it, but they are the youth that are able to see that their friends and that people that they love can be harmed by it. The fact that our generation is, again, in need of evidence to prove that it is violent to police people rather than to provide health care, it's just sick. You know, it's disgusting. It's hard to find words to make it adequate, but it is not. And I don't believe in reform. I believe that we need to dismantle and we need to reconstruct all of the systems in America, because it is built on stolen land, as Dr. Boyd said.
You are listening to a webinar on policing and public health organized by Physicians for Human Rights. I just want to remind you for a moment of the importance of supporting local, community-based, non-commercial radio. We're living right now in an unprecedented period in U.S. history. During difficult times like these, we all depend on KABU to bring us perspectives not found in other media. You look to KABU to bring critical perspectives to important issues and discuss these issues in meaningful ways that go beyond superficial news coverage and dig deep into the story behind the story. As I look for news and analysis online and on other stations, nowhere else do I hear the thoughtful dialogue and the inclusiveness that I hear on KABU Radio. if the free flow of information and perspectives available on KBOO matters to you, then I urge you to go to your computer and pull up KBOO.fm to support community radio at this crucial moment. You can also do that on the KBOO app or on the website KBOO.fm.
There are people who will say that the police are human too. They have grown up in a racially divided society where it's impossible for them not to have acquired racist ideas if they actually, regardless of their own race, to be honest with you. The question then is, why wouldn't things like implicit bias training make it better, or training police in de-escalation techniques so that a confrontation doesn't become a war of wills, but instead the police know how to de-escalate rather than... So anybody want to speak to that? I think many people do ask that question, and I think we should accept that it's a well-intentioned question. I guess the panel and everybody is probably well aware of my own views, but let me push the panel a bit. Wouldn't it help some to ensure that police got training that made them less likely to use their weapons and less likely to see people of color as criminals without actions to to support that?
In my opinion, we should not use a policing force with weapons to allocate public safety for any people, and especially not Black people in this country, when inherently Black people have been commoditized as slaves, as enslaved people, and for whatever reason, our systems still allow that commodity. And the protection of police, of property, is to ensure that that commodity continues to be held under that type of authority. Like, police have to go in order for us to move forward. That's just how I feel. I've not seen evidence that they keep communities safer. In fact, in our community right now, since the Black Lives Matter protests have happened, they've refused to investigate murders of Black people, including children, and they've cited that it is the protests that are keeping them from doing so, even when the federal government was out here showing up at the protests and people were leaving the protests and being murdered. They don't have... I don't think there's anything on the book. I've talked to the police association president out here, Daryl Turner, and he said there was never any mandate that they protect and serve us, that his job as the president of the police union is to protect the officers. The officers are employees of the city. Their job is to protect the city's assets, not the people. So if that is the fact, why aren't we investing in doctors when we have so many at-risk, marginalized, and vulnerable people in communities that are used and often policed? Like, we can't use police in the future.
Completely. We just posted the link to one of your reports, Rhea.
So implicit bias won't work because it misses the structural underpinnings of police violence and their systematic nature. Implicit bias tries to teach an interpersonal intervention, that when you see one person, when you as one person see one other person, that you might feel differently about them. And if you feel differently about them, you know, that you might treat them differently. But what prevents that from actually helping is what Teresa's saying, that we have police that have militarized tools, right? If you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If we give you a tool of violence and that's the only tool at your disposal to solve a problem, that is a tool that's going to be frequently used. You know, if we then surround your use of that violence with laws that then allow you to use that violence with impunity, right, with qualified immunity, with allowing police officers to be hired in other forces despite histories of past use, which is a high predictor of continued use of force for officers, including lethal force. When you allow those policies to then persist, you show that, you know, violence is the tool you want police to use. And when they use that tool, they can do so, you know, with impunity. So police violence is a systematic problem. It has structural drivers. And many of the, you know, reforms that people call for are to try to tease away some of those structural drivers, to demilitarize police, to defund police, so that they don't have the same amount of resources to buy militarized tools that they will use against civilians. And so that, as Teresa was saying, you can invest in an alternate way of meeting people's needs, of serving people's needs. I'll give one example from here in California. So in California, we have open criminal justice data. It's called, I think it's called Open Justice Portal. And it was started by Kamala Harris, for however people think about her now. And the benefit of it is we can look at police use of force across our state every year. And in 2019, when police used force, 50% of the time police came to the scene at all was because somebody called for help. 50% of the time. When police used force, it was because somebody called for help. 55% of the time, somebody's going to suffer a serious bodily injury, like Mr. Blake. And 1 out of 5 times, somebody's going to die when they were just asking for help. It's why we're talking about who should you call when you need help? Who would you feel safe if they came to the scene? And what tools do they need to have with them? Increasingly, we're saying that tool is not a taser. It's not a gun. It's not pepper bullets. It's not tools of violence. It is helper tools. And so who are the helpers, and how do we expand a workforce of helpers? I think absolutely we should have more, and I saw this question in the Q&A, absolutely we should invest in the crisis intervention teams that put social workers and mental health workers onto teams that respond to acute, of course, psychiatric crises, because those are also people who are vulnerable to police violence. But we should also think differently about who works and is employed and makes money off of our care economy. Because in healthcare, we have a workforce that's predominantly white. When you talk about shifting that money to hospitals and to doctors and to social workers, in many parts of the United States, you're not talking about addressing the racial economic gaps that also exist in society. And so I think we also need to think about caregiving and actually paying families and neighbors to show up for each other and equipping them with tools so that they respond when people need help, as an alternative to these punitive, you know, departments we have in our cities now.
One of the questions, and Mark, I know you were going to come in, but one of the questions in the chat was, why not have greatly expand the workforce of social workers and mental health workers who work within police departments? If you could also fold that into your response.
Sure.
Whatever comment you were going to make.
Yeah,
Bria was saying that we need to have a different way of thinking about who should show up when someone needs help.
Right. No, I definitely. On the question of, just briefly on the question of training and de-escalation, it is undeniable that police come from our society. They are a product of our society. They aren't an alien force that exists outside of it. So very much so when we are talking about the issues within policing of violence and anti-Black racism in particular, that is a societal failure. But there's also a funnel effect into policing where many departments and, you know, culturally, whether it's from cop shows or even actual recruitment material, very much promote a warrior mentality of policing. So it funnels even more so the type of people that are going into policing. And the problem with training, and for myself having worked on and supported efforts on training and practical operational reforms with police, is often you would see, you know, training happen in an academy or in a course. You know, officers would come in, check the box because they would have to be there, may check out. But then when they return or they enter the force, they'll talk to a sergeant or an older officer, and they say, forget everything that you learned in the academy and listen to me if you want to get home safe at night. And everything's based on that. It's based on you are under threat and you need to get home safe at night no matter what you want to do, or no matter what you need to do. On the point of de-escalation, just a note too, I think although they don't often do it well, police know how to de-escalate. I think about the discussion around diversion as well, and we have supported and there's great work people do around, a program like LEAD, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, for instance. But diversion and de-escalation exists, and police have done it, and they do it for certain people. They do it for white people. I know in my neighborhood when I grew up, if there was a young person who was using drugs, they would be diverted. They would be told, their parents would be told to come and talk to them. They would be linked with a health provider. they wouldn't be arrested and sentenced, you know, maybe even up to life in term, life imprisonment for a third offense. So these are all things that occur and exist. It's just a question about who is it given to, right? It's not a question about, do we need to have this? It's actually just about, why isn't de-escalation, why isn't diversion being used for Black people in America? And that's why a program like LEAD or others has been so radical, because it's talking about something for Black people in America. So yes, I think we do need to invest in mental health providers and social service agents as well. Personally, you know, I think because of how deeply embedded everything we've talked about before around concepts of disorder and how that's associated with race and also class in this country, the idea of completely removing police frightens a lot of people. So there have been efforts to try to have, you know, accompaniment from mental health providers or social workers. But I think that we need to move beyond that, where we can have the responses, much like Rhea was describing before, that are really grounded and situated in the communities where people live, and without the potential for violence that comes when somebody with a weapon arrives as well.
One,
thank you. We have only minutes left, and I think maybe we should turn to what can we do? What do the members of the panelists think that people who work in the health sector can do, or people who work in the criminal legal system can do, or what as members of the public can we do to make the kind of change that we all have agreed and I think is widely agreed is needed. One thing that we haven't noted is that the U.S. has more people dying of all races at the hands of police than any other wealthy country. We are extremely violent when it comes to police-involved deaths, and it would take the U.K. something like 50 years to achieve the number of deaths that we accomplish in just 1 year. But what can we do? What should people take away, even as we respond with sorrow and anger? I think it would be great to hear about actions. We should run for political office, Teresa.
Well, some of the things that we've done in our organizing is we've supported like our labor communities. We've supported home health care funding so that people like my cousin can stay at home with her dad, or, you know, families that have children with disabilities or PTSD can have those same resources that we would provide to a provider, a healthcare provider. Getting that type of credentialing in communities that are deemed vulnerable and at risk. But Dr. Boyd was right in regards to the representation in the healthcare industry. I think that as the country continues to talk about reparations and the dismantling of systems of oppression, that we need to look at the firm investment needed in people that can provide those services in our communities, and the investment needed in that generation that needs that vocational outreach so that they can find their interest in those industries of healthcare and legal and social engineering, because it's going to take a radical change and a radical shift for America to change the way that we do and provide outreach to the people that live here and the way that we manage why we have that outreach in the first place. But I think that if we take the lead from the next generation, that is very simple, that we provide care, not cops. And that we intentionally dismantle systems of oppression, because those constructs are outdated and were set up as white supremacist ideology on a land that was stolen from people that still occupy the land. And we know that it's sacred, and we know that they've made a shift in their identification of what resistance is. So if we want to listen to the world and how they see us, America should start just investing in the future of our healthcare and make sure that families have what they need right now. A lot of the gun violence that happens in our community, it is systemic, but the oppressors that identify the needs and support systems for families are discriminative. And so those outcomes do lead to more violence. Until we deconstruct those systems of violence, things won't change. And so I'm with you, Dr. Bassett, on the need for electing leaders that have the experience and the ideology and the courage to make change happen right now. We don't need to follow the status quo. We have to be innovative in the way that we dismantle it and discourage the use of it. And so let's be radical. Thank you for
Thank
having
you. Me. Thanks. Thanks, Teresa. And to the rest of the panelists, I have to apologize. Our time's up and it's time for me to hand it back to Michelle. But I'm going to just make one plug. We need more people to at the polls. I just heard today that LeBron James is getting together with other athletes to support a huge investment in making sure that there are people at the polls so that we can keep those polling places open. A lot of those people who work them now are elderly. Because of COVID, they should not be out there. So everybody should look up and see if you're somebody who feels you could do this, how to become, I don't think it's called a poll watcher. Somebody help me here.
A poll worker.
But it, huh? A poll worker. So anyway, with that, Michelle, thanks very much to the panelists and to PHR for enabling this conversation to take place. And over to you, Michelle.
And I'll say right as Michelle gets on, we need police-free schools and police-free hospitals. Please call for that in your area and call for it if you are a healthcare worker yourself.
Okay, yes, yeah, another type of sanctuary hospital. Thanks, Rhea. And thank you, all of you, for this incredible discussion. I know I certainly, as a representative of a human rights and health advocacy organization, am taking away from all of you, we need more accountability. Rhea, the fact that 99% of all police killings, the officers are not even charged, that has to change. We need accountability at all levels. And I think what all of you are emphasizing, that we need to advocate for resources to be directed to caring, at helping services rather than punishing and the use of force. And one of the panelists, I think that was you, Teresa, saying it should also be neighborhood, or actually Rhea, sorry, that, you know, it's not just investing more in formal services, but neighborhood support, neighbor trained peers. These resources need to be go towards a culture of caring and helping. One statistic that I didn't hear today, but is also true, that 25 to 50% of police killings occur in response to mental or behavioral health crises. As Rhea had said, 50% are people asking for help, but 25 to 50% are in response to what really are health, mental, behavioral disabilities. Thank you again. I hope all the audiences feels mobilized and that our speakers have left us with a plan of action. We're going to vote. We're going to advocate. We're going to learn. We're going to push for changes, not just superficial reforms, but structural reforms. We're going to take a break next week. Next week, we will not have a webinar. The next week after that, Thursday, September 10 at 1, we're going to talk about the challenges of back to school during a pandemic. So we'll have a number of experts. I think a number of panelists on this are grappling with this as well, having school-aged children, having addressing the questions of going back to school. So thank you so much. This conversation will continue. We all will continue to advocate. And again, we all are going to vote. So thank you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion on policing and public health, featuring Rhea Boyd with the California Children's Trust, Mark Krupansky with the Open Society Foundation, and Teresa Rayford, founder of Don't Shoot Portland. To finish off the hour, we'll bring you a short piece from Outcasting Overtime, a program featuring personal stories and opinions of Outcasting's youth participants who are LGBTQ and straight allies. This segment is from New York and focuses on Black Lives Matter protests.
This is Outcasting Overtime from Media for the Public Good, producer of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Hi, I'm Lucas, an Outcasting youth participant. In 2019, New York City hosted World Pride for the first time and celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. As it has for decades, the celebration included elaborate floats, rainbows everywhere, and a party that seemed to go on all month long. In 2020, of course, LGBTQ Pride Month in New York look very different because of both the mass shutdown caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests, sparked by the killings of black people by police without apparent justification. Most recently, at that point, the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. This reminds us in the LGBTQ community of the beginnings of our own fight. Black and brown LGBTQ activists were crucial to the modern gay liberation movement in its nascency. Marsha P. Johnson, a black transgender woman, was a key figure in starting the Stonewall Uprising in 1969, which arose out of a police raid of a gay bar, the Stonewall Inn, in Greenwich Village in New York City. The first gay pride march a year after the Stonewall Uprising was a celebration of gay militancy and the activism that had taken hold during that first year after Stonewall. Over the decades, it grew into a spectacular celebration involving millions of people in New York City, not to mention countless more in cities around the world. Some people think that the march has grown too spectacular and commercial, and in 2019, a group called the Reclaim Pride Coalition held an alternative march intended to get back to the spirit of the first gay pride marches. In 2020, the COVID pandemic caused the initial cancellation of both the main and alternative marches, but the killing of George Floyd prompted the Reclaim Pride Coalition to undo the cancellation of its alternative march and hold a protest march specifically in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. The fight for LGBTQ equality is not done until everyone is equal, both in and outside the LGBTQ community, including brown and black people. Black lives are human lives, and here at Outcasting, in observance of LGBTQ Pride Month, we wanted to amplify the voices of our black neighbors fighting to end systematic racism and police brutality. On Saturday, June 6th, the peaceful town of Ossining, in New York's lower Hudson River Valley, came alive and made its voice heard. Hundreds of people gathered at the Hudson River waterfront and marched through town to another park to protest police brutality and to show their support for the Black Lives Matter movement. Black activists of all ages, youth performers, and the Ossining Police Department expressed their grief and outrage at the deaths of George Floyd and so many other black Americans. Nadia Zaidan, one of the youth organizers of the June 6th protest, spoke about what Black Lives Matter means to her as a non-black person of color.
As a person of color, I do understand on a personal level what it means to face these like microaggressions, these racial injustices. And I know how it feels for your race and for your appearance to be an additional stressor in your life. And it really does take a toll on you. And right now, like, if we're being honest, it is the worst for black individuals in America right now. So I just think we need to, like, stand up for the people who need to be heard the most. Because knowing how it feels, nobody deserves that. Nobody ever deserves to have their race or the way they look be an additional stressor on their life. That should not be a hardship for them. Because a lot of people will try to say we're colorblind or that they're not racist. Or that they're not racist, but colorblindness does not exist because it is a system of oppression and a system of privilege that is working against people of color in our country. And people really do have to speak out against that and speak out against that system. We have to reform that system. We have to change that. And we're never going to change that system if people don't recognize their own privilege and if people don't listen to the voices that need to be heard.
Cheyenne Bell, another youth organizer, told us why she's fighting.
To me, I would think it's doing what's right for people of color, specifically black people. It's fighting for something that we should have gotten a long time ago, but never gotten. It's so much more than just protesting and posting. It's fighting for what we need as people to survive.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
After 2 hours of marching through the streets, the group spread out across a baseball diamond to hear a prayer, a song, and a speech, all demanding action. A woman in the audience held up a large rainbow flag with BLM written in bold letters. Finally, the whole park fell silent as everyone went down on one knee for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the same amount of time that the Minneapolis police officer knelt on George Floyd's neck, causing his death. When the event was over, I spoke with Jelaine Knowles, one of the featured speakers.
The Black Lives Matter movement means the world to me right now, especially because of just, I feel as if enough is enough. Enough has been enough, but now our momentum has changed and people are speaking up. And what this movement's different right now, because I believe there's more people who are advocating, more people who are willing to educate themselves, more people who are willing to listen, and we're forming allyship. And for me personally, my main focus in this is our youth, our kids. I work with kids at Roseville Elementary School here in Ossining, and I absolutely adore them, and I want a better future for them because they ask me questions about this. I want to tell them that their future is going to be better. And I am just so passionate about how we need equity right now. We need help. And after that is when we can talk more about equality. But right now we need help. So we need voices. We need allies. We need people to speak up and continue the conversation so we can keep going.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
The rights we now have as LGBTQ people have resulted in part from the efforts of Black LGBTQ activists. So while Pride Month has ended for this year, the fight for Black lives continues. And although the protests aren't dominating the headlines as they did in June, at least not right now as we record this, it's important that you keep educating yourself, supporting Black-owned businesses and Black content creators, and signing petitions. And keep in mind that if you're of age to vote, one of the most powerful ways you can support Black lives is to vote for candidates who support equality for all. You can view a slideshow of this piece with photographs by Outcaster Justin. You'll find a link on our website, outcastingmedia.org. Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime from Media for the Public Good, producer of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to all Outcasting content. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky.
Gail Sheehy, noted journalist and author, died on August 20.